This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
Hey everyone, before we get into today's episode, I just want to let you know that our friends at Outdoor Edge have partnered with some great brands to help bring your fall full circle with their Field to Freezer to Fire giveaway. Here's how you enter. Go to their Facebook page and sign up to win some awesome prizes and packages from brands including Yeti, Weston, Bradley Smokers, and more. These are some awesome products that will help you process your game, keep your game in the freezer, and eventually cook it for your table. You have until January 15th to sign up, so take advantage of that. Outdoor Edge in the Field to Freezer to Fire giveaway. Go to their Facebook page and make it happen.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
What you got there? I found this.
What?
At the... remember that little store, Crane's Country Store on...
Oh, yeah. 70?
70.
Yep.
And...
You couldn't resist.
I couldn't.
It's like you buying flashlights.
25 bucks.
Huh.
And I'll show you what makes it pretty cool is... So what I'm talking about for our audience is I bought a knife that's kind of one of those removable...
Blades.
Removable blades knives. And then it comes with this, too. I think it's called True
Knives. It's like a garage door opener. What is that? So you just carry...
You can carry that if you want.
You're a sucker.
But it also has a saw blade in it as well.
They got you.
They got me. You know?
They
got
you.
Might be one of those things, too, that
somebody... It actually looks like an old... Like a lighter. Like a, and that thing is like looks like a
fuse. A little Zippo lighter.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's where your extra blades carry. But 25 bucks, I was like, you know, it's actually got the clip... And after having to clean,
are you trying to sell me
my
one now?
Buck? No, I'm just showing you. Figured you'd like that.
You're gonna mark it up, weren't you? You're gonna sell it to me and mark it up.
No.
then you're gonna whip out one. This is the one I actually bought for myself, but I
yeah,
just I wanted
no,
to
no. Keep some money on it. I bought it because I had to. The day I shot that buck. And I somehow my other knife was not in my
truck or wallet?
Truck or backpack pocket. For some reason. So I had to clean that that deer with a pocket knife.
Yeah.
With my Vortex. I think it's a Kershaw knife, but I got it from Vortex. I had to clean it with that. And it's not a replaceable blade. I'm very fond of those replaceable blade knives.
They're pretty nice.
And so that's why I,
You broke down and
I'd never seen them before, but anyway. It's a nice little knife for $25, something like that.
Cool.
But anyway, guys, welcome back to Landing Lakes Podcast. I'm Adam here.
Matt is here.
And we are going to discuss something that I know because I'm seeing the posts. I mean, you can get on social media. People are getting fired up. Deer season is winding down for some of us. And habitat season is getting ready to hit full swing. And so we're going to do a podcast devoted to, I don't even know what we call it. We'll call this, I think this is podcast 281, if I remember right. 281 or 280.
It's got to be a 281.
281, hunting tactics versus land management
practices.
Yeah. And,
well, first off, I should say, I'm glad to be seeing posts about habitat, like people getting to habitat season, like, and it's a thing. That's encouraging.
We're inching along.
We're getting there.
Yeah.
And so I'm first off applaud that. That's good to see. But at the same time, I think we need to I don't want to say draw a clear line between the different practices. But I think if we want to make the impact that so many people are wanting to have on a given property, they need to know like where some practices would fall in retrospect to like true habitat management practices that are going to yield those results.
Yeah, and part of that is when I see, just like I said, we're inching them along. It seems like there's more people getting into habitat management, true habitat management, land management that we're talking about here.
It's happening.
And but because of that, we should also try to make sure we steer back onto the course or stay onto the course, because there is the fads that kind of hit the industry to where they're almost like distractions, where you're like, I'm going to go improve the farm, and then it's like, whoa, I saw this really cool thing. I'm going to go do that. And then before you know it, you're taking time away from what your initial plan was of improving the land.
I oftentimes, and talking to some clients or whatever, like the industry of like finance and investing often comes up, and it's like,
well, that's what a lot of our clients are in that field,
right? So it comes up often, but essentially it is the get rich quick schemes, like the Bitcoin, the I want to ride the stock market for a short term to try, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
it's like that same principle of people who are looking for those quick fixes or the get rich quick schemes are potentially the same ones who are falling for these practices that we're about to go over.
Get big bucks quick
versus a long term financial plan where you're stashing away or investing 15% each year and watching it grow and retiring millionaires or whatever. It's like, yeah, this is essentially like the same thing, just industry side by side.
And some of these, I would say, compared to like a, you know, I grew up in the 90s, and I was a big baseball fan. And so I lived through and watched the steroid era.
Yeah.
And the steroid era was, you know, pretty bad looking back at what it did. But some of these practices are almost like steroid shots for your land.
Yeah.
You might get the real quick, like, wow, I'm doing really good. I got ahead of my neighbors. I'm doing awesome. But the long-term effect of what that's doing to the land is bad.
Or that individual's body. It's like the side effect. It's like, whoa, hold a second. It's like you can get, let's just say, for instance, you put a mock scrape up. You get a picture of a big buck, you're like, dude, I'm doing it. Like, I am doing it. This is what I wanted to accomplish. And that's like that cheap, superficial, let's say, success. Because a deer is going to scrape anywhere. You could place a trail. You didn't have to put a mock scrape somewhere to get the deer scraping.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like those sort of things, it's just not long term, because the wind may blow over that mock scrape setup, and then it's like, well, crap, darn it, shoot.
And I've seen some properties where there was dozens and dozens of mock scrapes with that were pretty elegant. I've seen them from boards hammered in trees to create that limb just at the right height to the string tied up in the tree, yep, with the
grapevine
or sticks hanging down. And, you know, if it's not taking time away from your land management practices, then
cool,
then fine, have at it. But don't believe that what you're doing is, like, guaranteed you're going to get a good buck or a big buck or kill a big buck. I think a lot of these that we'll talk about come with the marketing or the advertisement that it's almost like a shake and bake. You just shake it up and dump it out and
shake and bake, baby.
And there's a big buck.
Yeah. Wait, and that's not how it works?
And that's not how that works. That's not how any of this works.
Well, you brought up a good point, though. It's like, that's not going to create more big bucks. Essentially, the secret or the straw that breaks the camel's back between these practices is, it's either here's something that may help you kill the deer that are already there on the property.
Yeah.
Versus, here are the practices that are going to completely change the landscape and increase the number of deer and the quality of deer that are on the property at any given point. It's not just like, hey, here's what your area is producing, because we're not actually touching the natural resources. We're just doing some techniques that are...
We're manipulating the landscape to try to attract the current state of the deer herd to come by or be within view of the trail camera or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, if the biggest deer you have in your neighborhood is a 130-inch buck and you do these practices, there is a chance that you may see him more.
Let's say an increased chance.
Or kill him.
Yeah.
And fill your tag with that, because you manipulated your farm to do that. Now, these other practices are the kind that, if the current state is a 130-inch buck and you do all these practices, you may notice within a few years, or certainly 5 years, that not only has your hunting gotten better, but you've also improved the overall age structure and quality of the set of antlers that deer carries. Can be, if you're done correctly and you do it to a scale, which I don't believe is a massive scale that you got to have 200-300 acres to make that change.
I don't think so either.
Because we should say, number one thing, the three things basically that are most important in getting bigger antlers is age, nutrition, and genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And we can control the first two. We can't really control the third one in free range whitetail very much. So age, so we stop shooting young deer.
Yep.
Two, nutrition. We make more forage available that's also more nutrient rich and
year round,
and we lower stress periods.
Yep.
And I would honestly say that's periods. The two things I focus on. The genetics, I can't cull my way to giant deer
success. No.
And
nobody can.
And so I don't. That's like the thing that I can't even worry about.
I mean, it plays a factor, but honestly, thank goodness that we can't, as humans, impact another factor that. That changes.
Like, I want to be a really good runner, but I don't run good on days with low barometric pressure. Well, I can't control that, so I just got to be a good runner.
Got to be a good runner.
Yeah.
Well, I just got to have a great property.
I just
got to
can't stop running.
Kept on running.
So,
let's break out. So, we've got essentially hunting strategy techniques.
Yep.
That will improve the success in the field. Or your ability to document the deer herd, what they're doing at any given time in the season, so then you can make better hunting decisions and hopefully capitalize on deer that are already there. You're not changing them, or you're not improving them as an individual or as an overall herd. You're not improving the deer with those tactics.
Yep.
Versus land management practices that are impacting the natural resources available or creating different natural resources for wildlife.
Yep. And some of these spill over. It's just in the way that they're utilized to say if it's going to make a large scale impact.
So kind of going back to last week's podcast, it's like, okay, so what are your goals? This is like that check. Restate them in your head and then go through these and say, well, where's my time spent? What am I doing? Are these the practices I'm choosing to do? Well, I may not be reaching my goals because I'm thinking too short-term versus not enough long-term practices. And if you want to make the big difference, it's not going to happen just snap of fingers overnight.
Yeah.
So what do we got for the hunting strategy practices that we commonly see going into – I'm air quoting the habitat season, that are going to yield less than desirable results for someone wanting to make a big impact?
So I think one of the – I'll kind of bounce around on the list here, but one of the big ones, of course, we're coming up. It's December, so we're getting into where a lot of natives are being planted. And one thing that I see a lot with – because of the season of planting – monocultures of grass,
yeah.
I see being planted now. Not to say, you know, if you go and grab a native grass, one species of native grass, and you go plant 20 acres of it because you're trying to create bedding, you could technically fall in a category of keeping some deer to survive to where they reach the next level of age. But the overall impact and the overall goal isn't in a true nature's designed land management technique. And I say that because nowhere in nature will you find naturally occurring monocultures.
A sea of single species
of
grass.
A sea of one grass. And so we really advise people not to plant monocultures to a large scale because it's not fitting within nature's design for land management.
Or if you have the option, which is even better, even if you're trying to do like the big three, right?
Uh-huh.
Big blue, little blue, switch, or big blue, Indian grass, and switch, that's still just all grasses.
Yep.
It would be more better if you could throw in forbs, native forbs, to go in with that mixture.
Yeah.
And that's now diversifying that 20 acres. Still, you're not giving up cover, but you're adding food. And that is what would naturally be found occurring across a landscape the way God designed it.
Yeah.
And so we're killing multiple birds with one stone simply by just a slight change in the mix that would be planted.
Yeah, because you're providing a blend that, just like most places in nature naturally occurring, you'll find where there's cover available for many species as well as food available for many species. But when you plant a sea of thick switchgrass for cover, first off, I think there's better options. I know there's better options. But second off, there's no food value.
Right.
And there's no food value for not just deer, but a lot of species.
Oh, yeah.
A quail doesn't make his living on a sea of switchgrass. A pheasant,
no.
Even, as a non-native bird, doesn't make his living on a sea of switchgrass. Now,
just because you can
stop,
find them there,
stop,
doesn't mean
everybody,
that
stop.
Not.
I know that you may say you're going to find them there in the middle of the winter because it's the only grass that stands up. But there's a lot of months out of the year where they need something to eat. And there's not snow on the ground.
Every month of the year. Yeah.
And so during that short little window, why are we devoting a large scale to help a bird or help an animal for a small window of time? Even in the north, you don't have snow on the ground from August to May. Lord help you if you do.
We'll see you.
You better start running a chainsaw and put some woody browse on the ground. But
we can't just continue to think about the hunting season for what the practices we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
Although we're coming out of hunting season, and it's great to look at hunting season and take your observations and say, here's what I can do to make my hunting better. Don't just do the practices that improve just the months of October, November, and December.
Yeah.
You're going to fail and not have the impact. So that's essentially what these categories are.
And even about monocultures of grass, whether it's 10 species of grass and there's hardly any forbs, it's still not quality bedding.
Correct.
Because you need structure, you need diversity. And so you could see, if I have a 20-acre field, this is my hang-up on CRP, is if I have a 20-acre field of dominating grass. It's over 75% grass. It's really low quality on my big scale, big view of
what you can't have,
of
right?
What I can't have.
Yeah.
I would like to see shrubs. I would like to see some dotted off, even young oaks, any kind of woody structure.
Yep.
And I would also like to see pockets of more forbs.
Certainly.
And so now there's a lot of guys that are planting like randomness of switchgrass in their fields, which if you were to just bag up a let's just say you've got a 40-acre chunk of a prairie and switchgrass is part of that, and I was just to bag up all the seed magically and plant it, you would notice that within time there would be pockets of naturally occurring thickets of switchgrass because that's the way it grows.
That's kind of the way it grows.
So it just does it naturally. You don't really have to go out and meander around and do it. And so the alternative to that, so monocultures of grass is a habitat tactic or a hunting tactic. And it's kind of a fad that people are using that I don't really agree with. The alternative to that, what would be more of a land management tactic, would be a diverse prairie planting, a pollinator planting, a mix of prairie planting and shrubs. Even some tree pockets, if you want. Even some riparian willow and buttonbush plantings would be amazing.
Or if you wanted still to enroll in CRP, also enroll and do down tree structures out in the middle of the CRP.
Yeah,
which isn't breaking contract or anything.
You may have to move them out for their humor at some point, but move them back.
But you can do that.
Yeah.
To create the structures that are necessary to bedding, but still have the income aspect of it as well.
Yep. And another alternative to the monocultures of grass would be old field management.
110%. Which is highly favored.
One of our favorites of removing, let's just say you even remove 20 acres of fescue by spraying it out, and then you just let nature tell you what's going to grow back, and if it's
guided along.
Yeah,
guide it through early successional plant communities.
Burn it every couple of years and just control the invasives. But old field management, and then add some shrubs, add some woody structure to that, and you're going to see an amazing difference.
Yeah,
so,
and that's naturally going to come.
And it's not – land management is not white-tailed deer. Land management is about all the native animals to that area. So we're trying to manage for all of them. And so if you're just doing straight grass, you're not really helping.
I mean, seriously, we talked about
animals.
This – several months ago, I believe it was, but maybe it's with Kyle or Frank. But literally, when do you find a turkey walking through a field
grass.
Of switchgrass?
Never. Well, even then, when do you find deer walking through? If you've got a well-established cave and rock switchgrass field, when do you see deer out loafing in that? Hardly ever.
Not a ton.
It's too doggone thick.
Not often.
You have to, unless you're burning it or mowing it or disking it just to keep it down from being so rank, it's not that great. So we've covered monocultures of grass and hunting tactics. And then
what's
in
next?
Land management side, we covered old field management and diverse plantings such as prairie and shrub plantings. Next one up, mox grapes. Hunting tactic has nothing to do with land management or habitat management.
You're not impacting deer's health. You're not getting them bigger. It's simply just a way to concentrate deer in a different area or at a very, very, very specific point that can help you target or kill a deer.
And we love mox grapes. We do them all the time, but we certainly don't go out there thinking we're going to change the deer herd because of them, because we're having them. Yeah,
and literally they take a little bit of time to do, but don't read into the beyond the impact that they actually have. It's literally they're just scraping your mock scrape and whatever is not going to like attract another big buck into the area that wasn't already on his way, right?
Yep.
Like there's already scrapes naturally occurring. They're just checking the scrape.
Yep.
So it's not doing anything besides giving you a point to photograph some deer.
That's right. Another popular thing that gets lumped in as habitat management or land management, and you think you're going to, you know, change the overall size of antlers. And this is a very confrontational one here, but we got minerals.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of research. Multiple universities just looked at very defined studies of controls and this and that. They just don't add up to changing the overall antler configurations by any percentage of increase.
And with CWD out now, I wouldn't. No. And it's not something I want to establish as a major mineral site.
And I know that comes to a blow or a shock to a lot of people, but it is we can't change it. That's just the truth of research. And what it does do, though, too, during the right times of the year, it puts deer in front of cameras.
Absolutely.
And again, it provides that falsehood of I'm giving them something that they need. Well, deer, just like a mock scrape, right? It's not like the deer needs you to put that scrape up. It would do it anyhow. Or it's not like the deer need this mineral block on the landscape because they're going to go eat native browse and get the minerals that they need out of it naturally.
Yeah.
Besides coming here, it just gives this falsehood of importance. And it feels like you're doing something, but in reality, you're not.
Yeah, and keeping in line with that, these are, we said hunting tactics. We might as well call them non-land management tactics.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they don't fall into land management, even though they're not really part of a hunting. But supplemental feeding is another one. And there's guys in Texas, yes, we get it. Your dry climate, that's the only option. We're talking about the guys who do recreational supplemental feeding and even guys who dump thousands of dollars in supplemental feed and
I would
protein
I would,
and corn in the Midwest and South and everywhere else.
Mid-Atlantic. I would argue that if you're doing that through certain months of the year, you're likely artificially impacting the carrying capacity of that area to an unhealthy standpoint. If you're selectively doing it during like times where there are periods of
limited resources.
Limited resources.
I think about the guys up north who
you're carrying over almost too many deer where the summertime and then the fall and then the bulk of winter when you're not doing it, they're stressed. Like the deer herd should not be at that level, and you're not helping those individuals. The overall herd actually needs to be shrunk back down into retrospect of what the carrying capacity is.
This is really, really kind of a sad way to look at it, but nature is very cruel. And nature definitely weeds out the weakest link.
It does.
And if we're stepping in to try to ensure that even the weakest ones don't get weeded out, we ultimately harm the whole entire herd.
Exactly.
And I think that's where a lot of times it's like, I don't want any deer to die. Well, then they're all going to suffer.
Well, and like, again, I'm not going to go and spend all that money to go and do that. And do it for a small portion of the time and hurt the deer herd, I'm going to go and probably cut some trees that are going to increase the amount of cover, but then give them woody browse through tough times and then give them more just browse throughout the summer and all the additional leaves and buds through the fall. Like I'm going to give it to them in different ways that's going to spread out the resource.
Yeah. So you lower social stress and everything, because that's another big thing about mineral sites and especially supplemental feeders during those stressful times is you take deer who are already stressed out because of the conditions, lack of food and quality cover, and then you put them all in the same place.
Well, and we haven't even talked about what that then does for the predator population too.
Oh, like gosh.
Corn. Everyone wants the badmouth coons, but you got 30 of them wrapped around your corn feeders. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
You know, some people call their feeders deer feeders. They might as well call them raccoon feeders.
Yes. Yes.
Because and that's all they feed.
But what do you think you're doing to that population too? You're artificially impacting it from a carrying capacity, and you're condensing them in and around focal areas that you want to hunt, and then you complain that they're actually there.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
Next one up, since we're talking about predators, recreational trapping.
Yeah.
And this is one of these non-land management tactics that ultimately they just take your time away from things that you could actually make a bigger influence or a, a bigger improvement on your land by doing them. So recreational trapping, what is it? And I need to define that before, because this is one of them that kind of spills over into the other one if done correctly, depending on what your goals are. Recreational trapping, if you show up on Saturday morning and you throw out a couple of traps and you go back and check them on Sunday night and then you trip them all and get ready to come back and on the weekend and check them, and you're running traps 10 times through the whole course of the year and you catch a couple of raccoons and a couple of possums and a coyote or two, you're not making a difference. That vacuum effect, those predators that you just removed are replaced within days, weeks, at the very most a month or two.
At that level, though, it's not even essentially a vacuum.
No, it's just
at that point.
Yeah.
And especially when most of those predators are getting ready to go into the breeding season of February, March, like January, they're completely expanding and shifting ranges. It's like that it didn't do anything. And again, for the 100 millionth time I think we've had to say this, if you enjoy it and you're introducing kids to it and whatever, fantastic. But don't, again, have work under the false pretense that it's impacting the deer, the turkey, in a super positive way.
That
it's
you're saving
not.
The turkeys.
Right.
I trapped a coyote. I'm saving the turkeys.
It's not how it works. It's not how it's going to work, no matter how much you want it to work. It is too dynamic, and you're not making nearly the big enough difference.
Yeah.
Period.
I almost have a Dwight K. Schrute kind of quote for you here. I trapped a coyote. I'm saving the turkey. False.
Yeah.
You're not saving the turkeys.
That's it. That's just it. Not by those practices, but practices like.
So switch that over.
Timber management.
If you hire, well, I was going to say recreational trapping versus hiring a professional trapper, and he's going to come spend an entire week or 2 weeks on your place, and he's trapping out, you know, you've got 200 acres, and he traps out a dozen coyotes and 30 raccoons and 30 possums. Yeah.
And if you can do
he
that.
He creates a pretty good impact still for just a period of time.
Yeah, and there's those states where you could trap ahead of
or during nesting season.
Exactly, fawning or nesting seasons. And that will make that temporary void. But again, the number of individuals that are able to pay for that type of service, that's the cherry on top, like on a Sunday, right?
Yeah,
I've got the banana. It's split. There's three scoops of ice cream, whipped cream, sprinkles. Now I'm going to start addressing the cherry because the habitat better be in place before that craziness
that
happens.
Time, yeah. You'd be better off hiring a chainsaw crew to come in and cut rather than hire a professional trapper.
And I great point. Someone's probably looking at that right now, and not trying to put any trappers out of business, but it's like, seriously consider that. Seriously consider the cost of what a 4-man crew for a week would do timber wise through TSI or FSI. Compare that to a month long trapping. Which impact's going to last longer? Which one are you going to see longer? Which one are you going to be able to tell?
Which one makes your hunting better?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A lot of false promise out there. Next up, fruit trees.
Oh, don't break my heart.
Yeah. Persimmons, apples, pears, all those things. Now, I like them. You know, it's cool. But to think that you have a food plot. Okay, I did step A. Now I've got to go step B. I got to plant trees.
It's a pimple on the butt of land management.
It makes no difference.
Like, you would have to have considerable number of trees, health of trees, on a property to impact the overall, let's say, tonnage that is going to be supplied through fruit trees.
Yep.
Now, again,
and you'd have to prune them every year. You got to spray them every year. You got to maintain them every year. Put the cages around them so the deer don't rub them and kill them.
Don't let the mower hit it when you're mowing your clover around the edge.
Don't let your herbicide drift.
Yeah.
All those things. And if you're willing to accept that challenge and plant
again,
a good amount, not to say, okay, you drop five apple trees on the one end of your food plot, and 10 years from now they're dropping acorns. Wow, magic
That's
trees.
That's awesome.
They're dropping fruit, they're dropping apples, and you're like, man, this is really – it's not like that's creating deer to be bigger and healthier and more daylight active on your property.
It's a little attractant.
Yeah.
To that food plot, and that's cool. But dadgummit, it took 5 years to do that, and how many weekends of work carrying water out to water those trees in and then spray and prune. I'm sorry, and I'm not afraid to work hard, but I'm not working that hard for that little return. That sucks. Just
return
flat out.
Of investment, not good.
Like, I would rather hammer that edge with edge feathering and be like, hey, year-round food right here on the edge. Come and get it. And I cut it, and I put a little bit of herbicide on maybe some stumps, and I walked away, and now I just include it in my fire unit every 3 years. And it's like cruise control. But yep. I have more food value and more cover value than those apple trees ever would have offered.
Next up, water tubs or holes. How, man.
Honestly, I just look at it similar to like the whole apple thing. There's going to be times where that
it works.
Yeah. Absolutely. And deer drink water.
Yeah.
It's true. They drink water.
Probably not as much as you think they do.
No. I think it's 80% of their water intakes through the food, right, through the metabolic process of breaking it down. So it's
but
like
that's not to say that if you have water available, they don't drink it. Keith
correct.
Was telling me about
correct.
When you guys hunted Paradise Point food
oh,
plot,
yeah.
well, and they kept everyone, going to that little water puddle.
Since that food plot has been expanded, anytime it gets a little damp, there's a little spot that holds. I mean, we're talking size of this grill here, like the hood of this grill. Like, it's tiny, but it holds a little bit of water. And yeah, I mean. Now, it's very nice and convenient that it's right there on their
path to the food plot.
But they hit it, and they stop. Yeah. I saw deer, back in October when it got a little dry in October. It was on a great rub line and scrape line, and $4 walked that line that one night, and sure enough. Three of the four drank from that little puddle that had been created there. Nice. Cool. But guess what? It didn't make them bigger.
Yep.
It is going to potentially help you kill a deer. Mm-hmm. But then I argue, too, that it's at very certain times of the year.
Yeah.
But guess what? If you've got a rainy October, late October, and November, all the time you spent digging, filling, putting that in,
and the biggest
really
thing
just didn't make a difference.
Taking water there.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we've talked with some people that have gotten it down to where I know one guy that, a client actually, mm-hmm. who has done it, but he gets in position where he gets runoff from the hill, and he's never had to
sure.
fill them up. And he's like, all
wise.
I did was dig the hole, put it there, and then now with runoff, I've never, and it always has water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was for a return on investment, that wasn't bad. You don't have to come back out here and water and fill it back up. That makes sense.
Yep. I get
it.
But it did not improve the overall health of the deer herd. It did not make that individual bigger, better, have better set of antlers. The 130 last year, he came by and he drank out of it four times. You got him on trail camera, and he's still a 135 now.
Yeah.
Like, that's cool. But it doesn't overall move the needle on any increases.
And if you're a person, a listener, that's like you're content with the size of the deer you have on your property, then by all means, do these and see if they work.
Sure.
But most of us aren't. Most of us are like, I know it can be better. And then do the other stuff on this that we'll read in a little while. Next up is, I almost want to paint the picture first. You're scrolling through social media. And you see a post where a guy's asking a question about what to plant in blank A, food plot A.
Okay.
And food plot A is just a smidgen bigger than my backyard, which isn't very big. It's 15 yards across, and it's 30 yards long. It's long and skinny, and it's got tree canopy going over almost both sides of it. So it gets a little sliver of full sun right in the middle.
Yep. Midday, early afternoon, you get a little bit of sun.
Yeah. And then when the leaves fall, of course, you get more sun. But when the leaves fall, the food plot can get covered up with leaves. Kill plot.
Oh, man.
Which kill plot is, it's just like food plot. Man, you can, some guys call food plots or hidey holes or kill plots or destination fields, feeding fields. I'm trying to think of some of the other terms that you hear with them. So it's a, it goes everything from the truck hood size all the way up to the 10-acre field that we all drool over.
But we're talking right here, kill plot, as in the small,
less than a quarter acre,
scratched
basically.
Scratched out kind of leaf blower blown in, broadcasted in small little tiny openings in the timber.
To where they compete too much, the nutrients is getting robbed from the trees that are still basically hanging over the opening. And you just don't ever get much productiveness out of it.
You created a...
Oh, what? or the half-acre food plot that has a dozen trees dotted through the middle of it.
That, too, just irritating.
Yeah. That's like the biggest... There's several sins of food plotting. Deep tillage...
Yeah.
And leaving trees in the field.
Oh, man, yeah.
Might be two of the biggest ones.
Or planting trees in the field, too.
Oh, no. Judas.
I went there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so these kill plots, again, from the size, you can get a couple little nibbles in there, right? That are going to
last. You get a lot more if it's natives.
That's going to last, you know, through the month of October, maybe, before it gets browsed down and whatever. But you're not, again, moving the needle on impacting the overall health. I think it honestly is, when you have some openings, it is essentially just a place where more social interaction can occur. Uh-huh. If you hadn't planted that opening, the deer would still come there and scrape along the edge. And if there were natives there left,
big piney opening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Classic example. Absolutely. Actually, where I shot my buck, mm-hmm. which I didn't shoot him in the opening. I shot him out at the edge of the hay field.
Yep.
But that is a little opening that...
Deer like hay fields then, huh?
They do. Love them. Especially fescue. No, travel corridor that dumped him into a downwind side of this little opening.
Yep.
And but that little opening has been, we get pictures up from deer on it almost every night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even though it's not planted, they still love being there.
Yep.
And they spend a lot of time there. Downwind side of a bedding thicket, little opening in the woods. Bottleneck.
Yeah. They're so small and so, they have such a small impact, though, too, on the actual food value of an area, of a farm, that is essentially just that communication post potential that, yeah, you see deer congregating in and around. And a lot of them, too, I think can be well-placed from hunters.
Yeah.
And so you have someone who wants to go in and clear out a spot. Well, because you're already seeing deer there? Well, yeah, they're going to continue to be there because they're already passing through. So it's like we're just trying to say from a kill plot standpoint, it's going to help you slow the deer down, concentrate them just a little bit more in that area they're already working through, but you're not impacting on a great big scale the overall herd health.
Yeah. Man. And so flip side of that, you go into large plots where that can be qualifying for land management or improving the overall productiveness of the deer herd, because we're talking anything that has, you know, 2 acres and bigger, or you've got 6 1-acre fields. Like, yeah, you're going to produce a ton of forage if you've amended the soil correctly and improved your soil health appropriately to where you can produce 3,500 or more pounds of forage available per acre.
5,000, 6,000,
depending on the
species.
That certainly makes an impact.
Yeah.
But not everybody's got that budget or the time or the size of the land that can handle that.
Or the equipment to be able to do it.
So that's where, you know, if I don't have the size of the land, the equipment, or the budget, it's very hard for me to say, let's do food plots, especially bigger food plots, because you just can't do it.
Yeah.
You're better off getting a chainsaw and running chainsaw.
Yeah.
I think that's a whole nother podcast. I don't even want to let the cat out of the bag on that podcast topic.
I was getting ready to let one out too, but we'll move on.
Last one for hunting tactics and strategies and non-land management practices.
What you got?
I don't know why this
one
fell in.
You got that spark on your face.
I don't know why this one falls in, but screening.
Oh.
Monoculture screening. Why is this getting called land management? I don't know. Why is it getting called deer management? I don't know.
That's not habitat management.
Yeah.
If it's a monoculture
screen. And if you're planting a non-native one, get out of here.
Give me
the coordinates.
I'll say this. It is just screening in general. A lot of places, it's a very necessary aspect.
And we recommend it to clients.
Yes.
From a standpoint of you're on a gravel road or you're on a highway.
Perfect
you need
example.
Screening.
Yesterday.
I
was in Tennessee. This farm in particular has a lot of gravel road frontage on many different sides of the farm and a hardtop road that splits it in the center. And so I was driving, and I knew I was still a little ways from the turnoff to the house where I was meeting the client. And I'm like, well, this is part of the property, because it was just both sides of the road. I was just meandering through a screen because it was open fields left and right. It's like, well, here, I'm on the property, or this is it, because, who else is going to do this? And it was very intentional, very necessary for them to do that. And they're going to continue
what
screening.
What was the planting? Or what kind?
He had planted last year. He had planted a strip of switchgrass. It had not matured yet. But then on the outside, closer to the road, he had just done an annual planting of Egyptian wheat. So it...
You hadn't been to this podcast yet, or this place
no,
yet, have
no.
you?
No.
So that guy listened to the podcast.
Yeah. So it's essential that screen be part of the plan.
Yeah.
It's not to take away, because he has to protect, all the other work that's happening. He's screening off essentially a lot of old field, and he's screening off future old fields and some future edge feathering and future food plots. So he will always be doing that.
Yep.
We'll go into a perennial, a longer term screen options, but right now has to do it.
Yep.
And
are you going to recommend, this is kind of the hang up where we will recommend a pure stand of a little strip, 5-yard strip of, or 10-yard strip of monoculture switchgrass in conjunction with shrub plantings or evergreen plantings, or even on the other side be going into native planting. We have to shield eyeballs.
You have to.
But also we need to provide some habitat.
Correct.
And so that's where
I'm not as worried.
Switchgrass being a native species, I'm not as upset about that. What I am upset about is these non-natives, untested,
we don't know long-term effects
sure. of these. We've introduced too many aliens and too many non-natives that have been bad.
Right.
That
have cross-pollinated and
certain stuff. At what
point
do we have to say, let's just, you know what?
Let's just stick with native.
What species did you say it was? Oh, it's non-native? Okay. You said enough. I don't want it.
So to answer that question, it's going to depend on the certain area. There's already some switchgrass coming in.
Perfect.
So that's fine. We're going to build off of that. But a lot of what the screen will be is until that continues to mature and before the old field actually fills in as well, so they're not looking just through a 10-yard strip of switch, going to continue to do the annual Egyptian wheat. Once that matures, then it will be a screen because it's already planted.
You should only have to be doing that for 2 years.
A couple years, yeah. But then it'll be a screen of switchgrass, since it's already there, already planted.
Yep.
And then it's going to blend into old field. And some of the topography-wise, you're not going to have to worry about it once those both grow up. So it's on its way. We're just tweaking some things. And there are some other areas where there'll probably be some shrubs planted because they're just wide open. And lots of discussions and people getting tickets, and he has seen just a lot of road hunting. So
fun
screening there, have to have it, but it's not an overall habitat management technique that is going to completely change the health of the deer herd. It may save a few deer, and that's important for the overall goal, but that 5, 10, 20-yard strip around a roadside isn't moving much of a needle.
So screening screening with monocultures is sometimes important, but don't think that it's just like, this is going to save my deer.
Correct.
Like, this is going to make big bucks.
Correct.
We may pay big bucks for it.
We're saving the views into the actual resources, like the old field, the edge feathering, like the managed timber, that's going to be beyond the screen itself.
And in land management, if you ever have a question, first ask yourself, is it native? Okay, now I'll hear you out. If it's non-native, be cautious.
Yeah.
Food plot varieties are about the only non-natives that we'll kind of accept because most of those are easy to control, don't have long-term effects. All right.
And most are annual species. Most.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's pretty much all the hunting habitat, non-habitat strategies or tactics that we list out that oftentimes gets labeled into land management, habitat management, deer management.
Mm-hmm.
Let's jump into some land management practices that we should be focusing on. It's almost like I have a honey-do list. Hey, I have a honey-do list, and I can't complete the ones on the left column until I complete the ones on the right column. And
Correct.
The right column is the ones we're getting ready to go over.
Yeah.
Once you do these, then you can waste your time on these others.
Yeah.
Or once you do these for the most part and hunting season is here and you can't do these other things, these land management practices, then you can do mock scrapes. Then you can do water holes.
So what you got?
So edge feathering.
Yep.
I mean, I was on a property yesterday. Props to this family. They've already done edge feathering years past.
Nice. How'd it look?
Grown up, needs it again.
Okay.
But they had done it. And they had quail. We jumped some quail.
Yeah.
But they had done edge feathering. Now, the dad, goal number one, more quail.
Cool.
I can get on board with that.
Yeah.
So, edge feathering. Man, we talk so much about it if you want to know what it is, but simply just soften the edge, improve the diversity around your fields, your food plots. Not only can you use it to, because if you do this, you're going to provide woody browse. Especially during the winter months, they can get in there after season and work around that and browse on that. They can even do it during deer season. But if you've got a food plot, they're probably going to prefer that over it.
Shrubs, stump sprouts, brambles, forbs, all mixed in one. That's
grasses.
It. Yep.
Yep. And so it's great. It's not only – this is the phenomenal thing about it. It's great for the health of the land. It's great for the diversity of the farm, but it's also a great hunting strategy because you can steer deer to enter food plots on your end where you can access better, as well as help screen you getting to and from the stand.
Yeah.
If, you know, over time as that grows up. So edge feathering, phenomenal. Don't know why we don't do it. It ought to be a requirement for all podcast listeners and everyone who hunts.
We need to ask before they go into the land wildlife community Facebook group and say, have you edge feathered before? You know how you get those three questions before you go into some closed groups? Have you ever edge feathered before? Yes. Okay, let them in.
Yeah.
Get in here.
What's the password? Edge feathered this Saturday. Welcome aboard. The next one, TSI, FSI, difference, timber stand improvement, forest stand improvement. Goal of timber stand improvement, we're trying to manage the forest to where we can grow some timber to produce income. But overall, we're just creating a healthy forest.
With varying age classes.
Yeah.
That's
and
so
FSI,
important.
You know, there's no timber value. I think of south-facing slopes, west-facing slopes in the Ozarks where probably not going to grow any timber, but I want to create a healthy forest. So I'm doing forest stand improvement. It's probably going to be a little bit more open, a little bit more sunlight reaching the forest floor. Man, you cannot go wrong with managing your timber and cutting out the weed trees. You mentioned crop tree release.
Yep. Yep.
So you can produce more mast and
that's the thing.
Both hard mast and soft mast, like fruit.
It's when it comes to FSI, like again, some trees that are potentially ugly, but they can be great acorn producers.
Yep.
They mass producers. They can do awesome. It's just, you know, identifying those trees and then going in and removing competition in and around those areas. And hey, look, there we go. Completed some FSI.
Yep. Next one, I mentioned it earlier, but old field management should be done. Anywhere you have open acres that's not food plot and not
I'm not going to lie. It's, honestly, I think it's my favorite.
Crops. You think overall old field management is your favorite?
I think so. I think because it's generally easy to create.
You just like being a lazy bum and a UTV spraying and listening to music.
Absolutely. And then fire, fun as heck to burn, but I just look at it from
the whole year. early successional plants.
And just the diversity that's in there, because you see rabbits increase, you see mice, voles, bobcats, coyotes, turkeys, deer, whatever, so many songbirds utilizing it. It's like, that place is alive and rocking.
Yeah.
Like, that is awesome. So it's just, it's dynamic. It impacts so many different things.
Next one doesn't get near enough attention. Not because we're not trying, but invasive species control.
My heart broke yesterday.
It says C in these notes. Did you write these notes? It says C, monoculture non-native screening for invasive control.
Take note. No.
Take note.
3 years ago on the property I was working yesterday in Tennessee was a select harvest. And now in certain areas.
East Tennessee,
course,
you say?
No, Southwest Tennessee.
Okay.
And, man.
This is what most government agencies are turning into. Invasive species control.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if it's quail forever, pheasants forever, NRCS, a lot of the field workers, they're turning into invasive species managers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in
that right there should tell you that's exactly how big of a problem is. If you're not aware of invasive species on your property, you need to be.
Get aware, yeah.
And you need to learn what they are in your area and begin treating, because you probably have them if you're not aware.
Get them while they're young.
Yeah. And so, but that's how big of an issue it's becoming. If those government agencies are putting or allotting so much money to removal. Termination of invasive species, but I walked into this area that had been pretty drastically opened, and it was in a low line kind of box elder type bottom, and it was just yellow with Japanese stilt grass.
Oh, no, I knew you were gonna say it.
And I just sat there. I was like, this just sucks, because it's like moving ahead. It's like, this is just going to be a struggle.
Yeah.
Like, this is just going to be difficult to address.
You're
going to
have to plant your flag and start there. It's
just
like,
no more.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like this, but it's like getting, hey, you have a terminal illness and your life is going to be difficult, and the road that you're about to go down is going to be tough.
We need some chemo treatment.
Yeah.
By chemo, I mean chemical.
I'm not comparing those two. We've all had individuals who have passed on, but it's just, it was essentially, I had to deliver some bad news that, hey, this is going to be the redheaded stepchild of the farm. Like, you're always going to have to just work this thing, right?
He just offended half of our listeners. It's 2020. You cannot say that stuff like this.
I guess not.
I'm wearing a brown jacket. I just offended half the people. I'm wearing blue jeans.
I don't like them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you to take them off, though.
Why? I'm just wearing thermals.
Okay.
It's past September
15th. It is
15th,
past September. You know, like my stinking grandpa. Well, it's past Labor Day, fashion rule. Yeah, till March 31st, I'm going to have these thermals on.
Turkey season's when I take them off. Gross. All right. Next one up, I have large plots, large food plots, destination.
Kind of covered that.
This
earlier.
Is expensive. And we have some nice ones on our place and some of the places we manage, but overall, you know, it's not something we don't recommend it a lot unless the landowner really wants more food plots. We don't recommend going in and hammering out 6 acres of food
plots. I don't know if I've
plots.
Ever recommended, like, going into a timber block and just demolishing and putting anything over 5 acres.
No, I know why. I am almost like, certain. There might be a client that says, false, you did it on mine. And I'm like, oh, I forgot about that.
But I
don't
really
think
can't.
I have.
I don't think I've ever recommended.
Because I do not like the large food plots.
Here's what I have done. And I was, so the day before yesterday, I was working at a different place, going back and remarking work that had been recommended through a management plan. And we were going and marking the property because he's getting ready to just get after it, man. He's about to just work. So it's awesome. But essentially, there's this ridge top. It will be clear cut, and he will have a food plot in there, but it's going to be like maybe 20% of this, let's say, I don't know, it's probably a 4-acre type opening, but it's not like a bedding deal. It's slowly going to be because it was once open, but now there's a little bit of value in there. So anyhow, it's going to get hammered. Stump treating, foliar application, some of the woody regression, and then burn it. So essentially, it's going to be long-term old field,
yep,
and a food plot in it.
Gotcha.
But that's the biggest opening. It's like, well, there's a little food plot. But yeah. It's 5 acres, but that's not the purpose of to put food in it, right?
Yeah. Next up, Young Forest creation. So it could be micro clear cuts. It could be Young Forest openings. It could be bedding thickets. They're all the same.
Yeah.
It depends on who we talk to. Micro clear cuts, I'd say clear cut because a lot of people down south know what a clear cut is or a cutover. We're just doing micro versions.
Yeah.
1 to 3 acres. Bedding thicket. I mean, we're creating a thicket that's going to allow deer to have year-round forage through woody browse and herbaceous plants, year-round cover through the structures that have fallen, and the new growth of the vegetation that's coming up. And then also, by doing that, you're going to have secure cover, which helps deer get older. So,
well, and I guess we haven't really been hammering this home. All of this moves the needle.
Yeah.
On
we will when we cover, get through them.
Cover and food value.
Yeah. Next one up, prescribed fire. If you can burn, burn. It helps with invasive species control. Like I was working with the guys yesterday in Central Missouri. They had bush honeysuckle scattered mm-hmm. through. And I was like, attack the large ones. We'll get the young ones with the fire.
Yep.
And so that's kind of one of those, like, once we get the big ones killed, a few might slip through the cracks, but if we're burning, we're going to keep them at bay to where even any automata that comes in, we're going to knock it all back.
Yep.
And so fire will be our – and that's a whole lot easier to control it with fire than it is ground assault with hatchets and herbicide.
Yeah.
So prescribed fire not only helps control invasives, promotes the new growth of very nutritious plants, improves cover in a lot of places, and overall it's just more beneficial – and it's extremely beneficial to not only deer, but all kinds of other species.
Yep.
Next one, last one, diverse planting. So whether you're doing a CRP planting or a pollinator planting that's highly diverse, 15-plus species or more, and you're mixing in shrubs, maybe it's not a CRP planting, but you're mixing in shrubs, you're planting some tree pockets, whatever it may be, riparian area, yep. All that. I think we mentioned it earlier. All that is hugely important. Not only provides great forage, but also great cover, not only to deer, but a long list of species. So
I'm just
those things, I'll list them out again. Edge feathering, TSI, FSI, old field management, invasive species control, large food plots, young forest promotion, prescribed fire, diverse plantings. Those are all things that's like, you know what? I'm listening to this. I've listened to this podcast a while, and I'm tired of hunting the same old mediocre deer that I have here. And I'm tired of wasting my time doing mock scrapes, screening, monocultures, grass, water tubs, mineral, supplement, recreational trapping, fruit trees, all that stuff. I'm just doing stuff. I'm tired of that. I'm just going to – now, instead of that, I'm going to take 2 years off from that. I may get back to it, but next year or this winter I'm doing – edge feathering, TSI, invasive species control, old field management, food plots, large food plots, young forest, prescribed fire, diverse plants. I'm doing those instead. You do that, you switch, I guarantee you, you would notice a change by next hunting season if you do them large enough, and it doesn't really have to be that large. And not only would you see it next hunting season, but 5 years later, you could still see the work that you did by doing these land management practices.
Without a doubt. there is there's a difference between like busy work and staying busy working.
Yeah.
Those hunting non-habitat management is simply busy work. The other stuff is the impactful things that are going to honestly, if your goals are set properly, going to make the difference and allow you to reach them, bar none.
There's dilly-dalliers and there's deal makers. And the people that are making deals and doing the stuff, the dilly-dally practice
is deal maker.
Just
I'm gonna go make a deal.
We're gonna get this done, and I'm just so tired of seeing wasted time, wasted energy for not getting the results that they want.
You know, hey, everybody's open to their own deals, what they want to do, but don't continue to complain about the same stuff if you're not addressing that through habitat management.
And don't,
properly.
Don't tell me it is habitat management. Don't give me gravy and tell me that it's jelly.
Ooh, that would be bad.
Because I know gravy ain't sweet.
Man, good luck to everybody out there.
If you got any questions, emails, shoot us info@landandlegacy.tv. We've got a lot of consults booked. Man, we've got a lot of inquiries coming in the last few days, too.
Keep them coming.
And so it looks like we're going to be traveling a lot. So there's a good chance we're going to be coming through your area.
Neck of the woods.
Hey. Never mind.
What?
No, I can't do it.
We're going to cut him off. We'll see you guys next week. Yep.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.